The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Second hour of the Bible Study, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Our telephone numbers, if you care to join the conversation, are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. I'm Chuck Rather. In this hour, we'll be talking with Reverend Dr. Anthony Steinbrunn. He is a mission executive with the New Jersey District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the church body divided up into some 35 districts. And the New Jersey District does its work out on the East Coast. Dr. Steinbrunn handles mission work, I guess, for the New Jersey District. Good morning, Doctor.
Morning. How are you doing, Chuck?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, I'm thinking a generation ago, if you said that somebody was a mission executive or involved with mission work, everybody knew what that means.
Sure.
But I don't know that everybody knows what that means anymore.
That could be. Sure.
I don't think what we would call missions or mission work is a high priority for a lot of people these days.
Yeah.
Has that conviction on the part of Christians been in decline?
I would say you're right. It seems like if you study the history of the Christian church and missions, the 19th century, in a way, probably Chuck was one of the great ones in a way. There was a lot of fervor among many to reach out to the nations and then bring the gospel to them. There is activity, of course, going on in the 20th century, too. But, I would say the 19th century. So it's been quite a long time, really, probably 3 to 5 generations of people. We're kind of away from that. But it's on the heart of people, but it's not like it was. I think you're right, yep.
I once had a pastor friend of mine tell me, Chuck, you know why we have a synod? And I said, no, actually, I don't. Why do we have a synod? He said, basically for 2 reasons.
Yeah.
To train pastors and to train missionaries.
Okay.
And I thought to myself, I tried to fit that into my bureaucratic model as to, you know, how all these districts and all these executives, all these people, how that all works.
Yeah.
How do you fit, as a mission executive into the structure?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say it's really kind of a nice place inside the structure because you're helping the church understand its identity, okay? Ever since the fall of man into sin, God has been involved in mission, and so we get an opportunity as a mission exec, Chuck, to go around and visit with pastors and congregations and just encourage them, remind them that this is part of our identity, is to, again, be concerned about the nations and how can the gospel and how can God's word, the law gospel, find a place inside the hearts and minds of people, at least have the message be heard. Romans 10 probably comes to mind, Chuck, when I think about a passage that's pretty important. Or 2 Timothy 3, okay, it talks about why do we have scripture, again, for salvation, to make people wise into salvation, but then also to train people for, again, their works of righteousness, okay, as they live out their life of faith.
Am I a missionary, Pastor?
Yeah, the way that I understand life, Chuck, is that each one of us is sent, okay? And that's really the root word for, apostle means sent one. And again, the root, I would say, goes into the sending that God does with each one of us. Again, we're born, and then the rest of our life, then God is sending us into different places, into different relationships with people.
You know, I was afraid you were going to say that.
Okay, there you go.
No, I'm not. Thank you very much, but I'm not a missionary, not interested in the job. As a matter of fact, that's why we have you, Doctor.
Okay.
Now, I don't live in the New Jersey district, so you're not my guy directly, but
sure.
We probably got somebody around here
sure.
that I can shove that responsibility over onto, and you say what?
Yeah. Well, there certainly is a place for maybe a position like mine, as I wrestle with that piece. But it certainly isn't to do the work that everyone else has been entrusted with. Each one of us, Chuck, again, I think it gets back to that parable of the talents. And God gives each one of us then the gospel, but then also other talents too in our life. These are the treasures that God's entrusted each one of our care. And he wants us to do all we can to prosper the master's business. And what is the master's business? It's to extend his kingdom, your kingdom come. And so, again, Jesus went about preaching the gospel of the kingdom, Chuck. So I think it becomes all of ours. I certainly don't need to be involved myself, and I need to be doing that faithfully. But at the same time, then, others, too, need to be involved, Chuck. So you're right. I know what you're saying, but it's really been entrusted to all of us, the gospel.
So
and the
as a mission executive, yeah. I'm thinking, what does that mean? Does that mean that he's extending the kingdom in Pakistan or the Sudan?
Okay.
Or does that mean he's extending it in Newark? Which yeah. of the two is more likely to be true?
Yeah. Well, again, the verse that comes to mind that kind of helps guide me, I think, Chuck, when I weigh this up, is Acts chapter 1, verse 8, where Jesus says, of course, you'll be my witnesses beginning in Jerusalem. You'll be my witnesses then in Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. So I've always kind of given more, not to minimize the nations, but it starts inside your own backyard, okay? So Jerusalem, the place where you are. And then Judea, you know, is the surrounding kind of area, maybe your county, your township, whatever it is, the kind of Chuck. And then, of course, it goes out from there. Samaria, it's geographically not too far away, but there's a lot of there's differences. Samaritans and the Jews had quite a bit of difference there, okay? And so you're doing some cross-cultural work as you reach out to the different people groups there. Maybe you're Samaria. And then, of course, the ends of the earth, Chuck. So I'd say it's both and. But it begins here. Do people understand the great mission field that now is North America? I think that is a huge shift for us, I think, as Christians that live in the States, Chuck.
Yeah. We have a story actually published yesterday on the ChristianPost.com website, written by Nathan Black.
Okay.
It says, Iraq's Christian minority took another hit Sunday evening, this past Sunday evening, when gunmen shot and killed an elderly Christian couple in their home.
Yeah.
The shooting took place in Balad Diyat, I probably didn't pronounce that properly, a predominantly Shiite area in eastern Baghdad, and was the latest in a series of attacks that has left dozens of Christians dead in recent weeks. Dozens of Christians dead.
Yeah.
Violence perpetrated by Islamic extremists has forced hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Christians to flee the country. Since 2003, the Christian population has shrunk from 1.2 million to 600,000 by some estimates. How does a missionary, Dr. Steinbrunn, how do you view this news? Now, I'm going to just say that I think those of us living in the comfort and relative peace of the United States, as Christians, we think that's a shame. That's too bad. But you know, after we think that thought, we're pretty much done with it.
Yeah.
How do you view this news?
Yeah. Well, I guess two things come to mind. You know, Chuck, whenever I hear that kind of a story, the one goes back to this great battle, this cosmic battle that's been taking place ever since Adam and Eve. And you have two kingdoms going at each other, the kingdom of Christ and then the kingdom of the evil one, okay? So these things are playing themselves out. So the parable of the wheat and the weeds, I think, in Matthew 13 comes to mind. And again, the gospel, you feel now for the people, you know, the country becomes darker. I think that's one thing that comes to mind for me too, because as Christians are removed from that place or killed, there is a witness, though, a powerful witness, and hopefully some will see that witness then, that they're willing to die for their faith and those things. But for those that say that there's only 600,000 left compared to a couple of million, again, there's less light inside that country. So I think that's kind of how I think on that piece. But then another the thing that comes to mind, I think, Chuck, is just the costliness of being a disciple, okay? Counting the cost. And, and death certainly can be part of it. Are you willing to remain faithful to Christ even to death? I remember that from confirmation. Okay, it's kind of a sobering phrase that Pastor said when you're 13 years old, and but it's always kind of stayed with me that that too can be part of the journey, even though, like you said, here in the States, we really aren't having to wrestle with that one too often. So, yeah.
Well, the Bible says, as you know, that when one member of the church suffers,
right, there you go,
we all suffer.
That's right, 1 Corinthians.
But when they're suffering over there in Iraq, over in Baghdad, they're so far away, we don't really suffer with that, Pastor. And maybe, I don't know, is that wrong? Or is it just a fact of life that when the church, which is now extends all around the globe, suffers all the way on the other side of the world, that you know, you could just have so much sensitivity. Now, if somebody in my congregation, if their house burns down, I can feel that. I know those people.
That's right.
And and if there's a call to donate clothes or money to help them get back on their feet, we know what that feels like. But when people are murdered in Iraq as Christians, I don't know. Do you have a sensitivity for those things?
You're right. That is always the part of the human challenge, I would say, Chuck, is that usually the people that live closer to us, that are connected to us, usually are on our radar more. And we do certainly have a sensitivity to that. And then we are willing to impact their life. I think that's right. That is it. But you lifted up a great passage, I think, that we all do need to reflect on, is that we are the body of Christ, and there's many nations, many tongues that are part of this, that picture in the book of Revelation there. And they too are brothers and sisters, and they are suffering. And the suffering servant, you know, Christ, is the one that suffered. And he calls the church then into suffering, but that means too, a part of it, that's the cross. Right? I mean, that's part of the cross, one of the marks of the church when Luther talks about that. He talks about the two primary, of course, the gospel sacraments. But then he, inside the council and churches, Chuck, he goes on to talk about the cross as being part of a mark. And I think as we suffer and as brothers and sisters suffer, we too suffer with them. Okay? So we need to pray, and we also too, I think, need to be sensitive to that costliness that they're going through. Yeah.
Okay, well now,
yep.
Let's turn over the coin and look at the other side.
Sure.
The story here on the Christian Post website says the deadliest attack against the minority took place just recently on October 31st when suicide attackers stormed Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad, killing 58 people and wounding 75. People will remember that was in the news.
Yeah.
The Islamic State of Iraq, an umbrella group for Sunni Islamic insurgent groups that include Al-Qaeda, has claimed responsibility for the attack at the Catholic Church.
Okay.
So not only, I think I would paraphrase it this way, not only has the established state, we're talking about the government here, and also the Sunni Islamic insurgent group, which includes Al-Qaeda, not only did they perpetrate this crime, but they claim credit for it. They're proud of it.
Yeah.
Now, as a missionary, Dr. Steinbrenn,
right,
how are you going to convert these people to Jesus?
Yeah.
They'd like to kill you, and if they could, they'd be proud of it.
Right. Yeah. Again, the power is always the gospel. But you're right. Again, this is part of that great conflict that's going on there, you know, Chuck. And you're right. What becomes the way in order to deal with this? I guess, you know, just trying to deal with Islam, you know, the people, the book, in a sense, maybe to try and get back to, again, I don't know how deep the thinking would be with this group. That's always the hard when it's a militant kind of the group going at you. But again, our common roots may be in Abraham, and to begin to talk about that, and then begin to move from there to some kind of message, you know, grounding it inside something that's familiar, Chuck, so that, again, you can bring them to a realization of Abraham's descendant, the special seed that came. But you're right, that's an extremely difficult place, a violent place. And what becomes the way? How do you go about enfleshing, embodying the gospel and a way of life that speaks powerfully to people like that, if they even give you the chance to be able to talk, you know, that becomes it.
When Christians hear about violence like this and mass murder and injury, which is accepted and credited to, I guess is the word I would use, credited to the Sunni Islamic insurgent groups, Al-Qaeda, and also the nation of Iraq, I'm thinking that a lot of Christians privately in their minds and hearts may be leaning in the direction that we've got to put a stop to this.
Okay.
We have to stand up to this kind of violence and hatred and do our due diligence.
Okay.
And I'm thinking that Christians think that thought first and probably don't think we've got to get those people to Jesus. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, you're lifting up a point, you know, because there is that part to us that if a person does take human life, that person should, there should be some kind of justice, you know, that's part of that, and that people are worshiping, you know, gathering together in order to praise God, and then to be killed and slaughtered that way. There's certainly a prophetic edge, I think, to us that wants justice to be done, and that it's wrong. So to invoke, I would say, temporal authority, you know, Chuck, in order to punish is certainly a proper thing. But again, the gospel too, we always know that the gospel speaks to conscience, and that's in conversion. And the great, the need that every human being has, of course, is to have their sins, of course, forgiven, of course, to have Christ, and to have eternity with God. So you're right, it's both and. But you're right, I think many would think, you know, maybe that is the reaction that many would take, is that this needs to be punished, okay, and then go from there, so...
The Pew Research Center has put out a new study. It's complicated, and I risk overgeneralizing here, so I have to be careful.
Sure.
But the Pew Research Center has done a survey, and they're pretty reputable when it comes to doing surveys.
Yeah.
They learned a number of different things that are all over the spectrum as it pertains to Islam and Muslim perspectives on various world questions.
Okay.
But there was one particular outcome that I of note, which I wanted to share with you. Out of this survey, at least three-quarters of Muslims in Egypt and Pakistan say they would favor making each of the following the law in their countries. Stoning people who commit adultery. Whipping and cutting off hands for crimes like theft and robbery.
Okay.
And the death penalty for those who leave the Muslim religion.
Right.
That means, Dr. Steinbrunn, if you were to somehow come in contact with an Egyptian or a Pakistani who was a Muslim and convert that person to Jesus, to Christianity...
Yep.
Three-quarters of the people in Egypt and Pakistan believe that person should then suffer capital punishment.
Yep.
Does that give you pause? How do you unpack that?
Yeah. Well, that is, that's, to be honest, you know, Chuck, that's consistent with things that have been advocated within Islam for a long time. So despite, you know, what some would say... I'm not surprised by those three findings.
These two countries,
I'm always troubled by it. But,
these two countries are, I think, sort of on the friendly side of center toward the United States, toward the West. They're not as hostile to Western culture and society as some of the other Islamic nations.
Right.
And 75% believe that if Dr. Steinbrunn converts one of their fellow Egyptians or Pakistanis, that they should die for that.
Yeah, that missionaries, you know, if you have the opportunity, you know, to visit with a, you know, the missionary or two that have worked inside those places, that is a common, though, kind of sentiment among people. And that's how strongly they view this. Because of the, again, the whole world should be a mosque. You know, Chuck, is really the thinking behind that. So every Muslim is expected and taught to do all they can to strive towards having, of course, the Quran, Allah, be known throughout the world, and that the world really become a mosque. And so they're being fairly consistent there, but it's a violent consistency there. But they're right. Somebody would convert. That means then that, you know, that we're not being faithful in our own turf in order to have Allah be the only God, okay? And then we also are allowing then evil, okay, things to be said about Allah, because those people are basically saying Allah is not the true God. There's another God, the triune God, see? So again, it's a twofold kind of struggle, I would say, that they are embracing, I think, in that kind of a posture. But again, it's extremely violent, and it's a misuse of the two authorities, and you can't have it. Satan, that's what he likes to do in every place he can, is confuse the two authorities, temporal and spiritual authority, and get people misusing force, you know, in order to kill and to rob people of life, Chuck. So now, it's not good, yeah.
I'll just admit, sure, that I think that whippings and cutting off people's hands,
right,
for crimes like theft and robbery,
mm-hmm,
do constitute cruel and unusual punishment,
right,
and do not characterize a sophisticated or modern world culture.
Right.
I have to admit that I look down on that.
Yeah, I agree.
However, if a Muslim were to say, well, Chuck, let me take you to Matthew chapter 5,
yeah,
where it says, for it is better that you lose one of your members than,
yeah,
your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off,
right,
and,
right,
throw it away. Chuck, you hypocrite.
Yeah.
You condemn Islam for,
right,
cutting off hands for crimes like theft and robbery, and here you have it in your own New Testament. What are you talking about?
There you go.
How do you respond?
Yeah. Yeah, Jesus there is talking about the body as an instrument of our spirit and soul, okay, of who we are. The heart is the real dangerous place. It's out of the heart that comes all kinds of evil things. And so it's the heart where the real war goes on. We would all be pretty mutilated, Chuck, you know, if that became the practice. So in what sense is Jesus teaching inside these things? Because each one of us, you know, let's say our eyes offended or done something wrong, we'd all be blind by age of probably 6 months, you know. So, you know, it really wouldn't take us long, Chuck, right? So I think that we have to understand the sense of these words, the way that Jesus has them. And, of course, Jesus goes for the heart. Okay, have your mind be renewed as well, Romans 12. But then the heart, all kinds of evil there. And so, again, we need clean hearts, like what David cries out inside the psalm. And, again, maybe that could be a way with Islam. You know, they do acknowledge David to be a prophet. And so look at Psalm 51. Maybe that could be a way, in a gentle way, in order to help people understand it properly, Chuck. Yeah.
One other thing here, and
sure,
I want to know if this is good news or bad news. I might,
yeah,
have to interrupt you as we get to the bottom of the hour here,
sure,
but we can continue on the other side of the break.
Yeah.
Is this good news or bad news? The Pew Research Survey also learned this.
Yeah.
8 in 10 Muslims in Pakistan say,
yeah,
suicide bombing and other acts of violence against civilian targets in order to defend Islam from its enemies are never justified.
Huh.
Majorities in Turkey, 77%, Indonesia, 69%, and Jordan, 54%, share this view. Support for suicide bombing has declined considerably over the years. For example, while 74% of Muslims in Lebanon said these violent acts were at least sometimes justified in 2002, just 39% say that is the case now. Which means that still 4 out of 10 people believe that a suicide bombing might be justified.
Yeah.
You can tell me if that's good news or bad news on the other side of the break. Dr. Anthony Steinbrun is with us here today on Ask the Pastor. We'll be right back.
I'm Dale Meyer. Did you ever wonder what kind of pastor or deaconess will serve the good news to your children, grandchildren, and the coming generations? Prospective pastors and deaconesses regularly come to Concordia Seminary to consider careers in the Lord's service. Please pray for them. And please encourage young people you know to consider the ministry for their life's work. Thank you.
Enjoy this year's Lafayette Square Holiday Parlor Tour, Sunday, December 12th from 10 until 5. You're invited to experience a glimpse of early Christmas holiday traditions and modern holiday collections in a tour of homes in historic Lafayette Square. And this year's Lafayette Square Holiday Parlor Tour invites you and your extended family to enjoy the sights and sounds and scents of a Victorian Christmas with lighted windows, decorated trees, carriage rides, carolers, and the Victorian neighborhood in all of its splendor. It's happening December 12th.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
If I asked you to name some heroes of the pro-life movement, you might pick famous or well-known people. Two of my heroes aren't talked about on news networks or blogged about on the internet. They're Esther Davis and her sister Dorothy. These ladies, along with their other sisters, seven in all, volunteered at the Cincinnati Right to Life office every week for nearly 30 years. They were dubbed the Tuesday Girls. Now only two survive. Dorothy is 91 and Esther is 80, but they plan to continue volunteering as long as God allows. And there are many others around the nation who have done the same. Well, today is Tuesday, so my hat is off to the Tuesday Girls as my heroes of the movement. Thanks for your help, and God bless you.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Correction. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. A letter signed by 42 members of Congress criticizes President Barack Obama for telling students in Indonesia last month that America's national motto is E Pluribus Unum. In a letter to the White House, members of the Congressional Prayer Caucus note that the national motto has been In God We Trust since 1956. The caucus chairman, Republican Congressman Randy Forbes of Virginia, says In God We Trust is too important to be forgotten.
Many of us are concerned to make sure that we stand for that proposition and don't retreat from it.
A New York company is offering GPS tracking devices that can be placed inside the baby Jesus in nativity scenes. That way, if a vandal or prankster steals the Jesus figure, it can be tracked down and recovered. New York-based Brickhouse Security provides a GPS device at no cost to nonprofit and religious institutions as part of its GPS Jesus program. I'm Steve Coleman.
The National Lutheran Choir returns to St. Louis this Christmas. This internationally renowned 60-voice choir from the Twin Cities will present a glorious new choral Christmas festival titled Emmanuel, God with Us, Saturday, December 18th in downtown St. Louis. More than just another Christmas concert, the choir will sing from all corners of Christ Church Cathedral, weaving poetry, scripture, and audience carols into a memorable program. There will be two matinees at 2 and 5 p.m. Tickets are available right now by calling toll-free 1-888-747-4589. A moving experience not to be missed. Emmanuel, God with Us, the National Lutheran Choir at Christ Church Cathedral, Saturday, December 18th. Call 1-888-747-4589 or visit nlca.com. Sponsored by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, Concordia Publishing House, and AM 850 KFUO.
Our guest in this hour of conversation here on our Ask the Pastor program is Dr. Anthony Steinbrun. He is mission executive in the New Jersey district of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you go to the website pewresearch.org, you can find this study that we've been talking about here. The headline is Muslim Publics Divided on Hamas and Hezbollah. There was a good deal of polling done by the Pew Research Organization on how the Muslim world perceives what we refer to as the terrorist groups Hamas and Hezbollah. You can read all about mm-hmm. that. I've chosen to focus with our missionary friend, Dr. Steinbrunn, on a couple of outcomes of this survey, the second of which is the fact that 8 in 10 Muslims in Pakistan say suicide bombing and other acts of violence, suicide bombing we're talking about, against civilian targets in order to defend Islam from its enemies are never justified. That means that 20% or 2 in 10 in Pakistan could be said to believe that suicide bombing sometimes is justified. Now, is that good news or bad news, Doctor?
Yeah. I would two things as I was reflecting on this, you know, Chuck. The one, I guess, that for me is that a shift? And if so, within their view of things, you know, over the last decade, is what has caused that shift? Is it their view of that person as a neighbor, okay, in their eyes? How does that person look to them, I would say? That would be, I think, an important thing to kind of gauge. And then I think within the culture, and I've been wrestling with this inside our culture, too, the last few years, is who comprises the canon inside your life? What voices help you make sense of things, okay? And so I think it'd be interesting to know, you know, the 8 out of the 10 that say that is wrong, do they find that from the Quran? Do they hear that from the local teacher? Where does it come from, this source, this teaching there? And is there a shift within the authoritative voices within that country in order to kind of that are grounding this kind of practice among people there, Chuck? So it certainly could be a positive thing, but that still is significant. Anytime you get 2 out of 10 thinking that any target that's out there that's in the way should go, that's still kind of alarming. Yeah.
Now, Dr. Steinbrunn,
right?
I would say, using my what I would call Christian sensibilities,
okay,
as I try to sort through the questions and the issue here, I would go so far as to say that suicide, period, is wrong. It may be explainable, it may be understandable for a variety of factors, but it is wrong. Committing suicide and taking 50 or 60 people with you is unquestionably, absolutely and completely immoral.
Yeah.
But apparently, 2 out of 10 Muslims in Pakistan wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah,
is it appropriate or inappropriate for me to pass judgment on Islam in general, given these facts?
I guess when that's an excellent observation that you've got there, Chuck. You know, what is the worldview of that person, of this 20%? Let's just focus on that 20. Their worldview basically is of one of intense combat, of war, okay? And so suicide, the taking of life and doing these things is not that troubling. And so you're dealing then with our worldview is different on that. And we would see that to be the fifth commandment and taking of life and those kinds of things come to mind for us, the way that we are formed and the way that we look at reality. And so that's a big piece of this. And so how do you go about then speaking into that and challenging, okay, exposing, unmasking the darkness behind that kind of a practice there, Chuck? So that's excellent what you just said. For us, morally, it's an extremely troubling thing.
So,
to take our own life, but then to take a life of a whole bunch of others as we go down, too, sure.
What if I were to anticipate an argument from a Muslim that sounded something like this?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, Chuck. You're just nothing but a hypocrite. We in the East, we in the Islamic countries, we're under attack. The United States is making war against us in Iraq. The United States is making war against us in Afghanistan. We are just defending our homelands and our religion. Now, when you Americans went to Europe in World War II, if a guy courageously left his foxhole and attacked a machine gun nest in order to take it out, in order to protect his men, and died in the doing of it, You consider him to be a hero. But when somebody from Islam dies in our battle against Western forces and Western culture, then you condemn that as suicide bombing. You're a hypocrite, Chuck. What do you think of that argument?
Well, that's, again, you're dealing with the just war, you know, and those kinds of concepts. And how to, again, first and second, I mean, the first temporal authority and spiritual authority, Chuck. This is excellent. You're hitting at, I think, the big pieces for us as we try to wrestle with this and give some kind of good answer, you know, for how we look at things. Again, I'm just relying on, of course, things that, you know, we've learned over time in ministry, but, you know, if our, again, temporal authority calls us and enlists us then to fight, we say that God is working in the two authorities, okay? And so, can a Christian, I mean, here's Luther had to write on this, can a soldier be saved? I remember it's one of his treatises he wrote a long time ago. If someone would go into battle and take another life of a human being, have they forfeited their eternal salvation? Becomes Luther's question that he wrestles with in Germany. So I think those things can help us, Chuck, as we try to sort this piece out. For me, conscience-wise, I didn't have to serve in Vietnam. I missed it by 2 years, but they pulled my numbers, and that was a pretty sobering day when they drew the numbers, okay? And
I remember that day.
Yeah, if they would have called me up, I would have gone to Vietnam. I don't know how well I'd have done over there, you know, and that kind of a terrain and stuff and things with the way the fighting had to be done. But that would have been challenging. But the bottom line is, you know, if the temporal authority asks you to do something, and of course, then the church, okay, can you kill another human being in good conscience if it's a war? Then the great question comes, though, the just kind of questions, and that's where we're moving into right here. I think Islam saying our cause is just because we're fighting for Allah, and you say that your cause is just. See, so this is where that's huge, Chuck. I guess I'd have to think on that more. I've never been really good at that side of it. I'm sure there's others inside our church body that really could do a nice job at speaking to this. But I'd have to think more, reflect. But those would be the two ways I'd go about it, Chuck. I'd be looking at temporal and spiritual authority and really wrestling with this
Our numbers are
the godly thing, yeah.
Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with James. Hi, you're on the Bible study.
Yes, Pastor. I'd like for you to kind of give me what you think the Islamic view versus the American view on this. If you're at war and say, for instance, it's battleships fighting at sea,
okay,
and you sunk one of the battleships, and there are survivors that are in the water,
okay,
do you save those survivors to put them in prison where they might get the death penalty, or do you allow them to drown?
Yeah. Well, for myself, I think we save life, and then we just allow, I think, things to be heard out. I think we always that is a good thing, a good question. But we always are giving our life for our neighbor, and of course we're fighting, we're taking life. But once the person is in that position, that helpless position, I guess for me, James, as I think about this, is that I, at least personally, I would hope that we would save the life and then allow some kind of judicial process in order to hear the case and see the merits, and then hopefully, again, a good thing, justice would be done, whatever that would be, James.
So the war criminals that you know have committed war crimes, you would save them to put them to the death penalty.
Well, now there's a difference between a combatant, somebody who is fighting on a battleship and following the orders of his commander, and a war criminal. Those are two different things.
Okay, well, I guess my scenario kind of falls through, but what I'm trying to get at is that what's just about saving life to kill it? If you If you are thinking of it as just, then you save the life to save the life, not to save it to bring it to any justice that might harm it at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thank you, James.
That's my comment. Thank you.
That's good, James. Yeah.
It seems to me that, as I think about his question, if I'm the, I mean, there are rules of war.
Right.
Not everybody, including the suicide bombers, follow them, but there are rules of war. They're generally accepted practices as to what is humane and inhumane, even in the conduct of war. But I think that it's more or less, or at least has been for a while, universally accepted that if you have an opportunity to take prisoners, you take prisoners.
Right.
You don't execute them. You don't have the authority to do that.
Right.
Once they have lost their capacity to fight, then you take prisoners, and prisoners are entitled to certain treatment.
Right.
Then after you, as the captain of the ship, hand them over to the proper governing authorities, if they are found to be guilty of something else and then subject to capital punishment, that's a lot different than me just deciding on the side of a ship to let them drown.
Right.
I would think.
Yeah. And historically, that's the way that we would have done things. See, again, just one or two scenes from Vietnam come back to mind, and that too would have been our military practice. You know what you just described, Chuck. Right. If somebody is surrendered, they're again compromised where they're not fighting. Again, we allow them to live. We take them as a prisoner. If they did covert things that were against, that are worthy of the death penalty, then, of course, those matters were heard and decided. So you're right. But often they are not. Just a soldier being a faithful combatant inside this whole conflict, and when he's once he's rendered incapable of fighting, then, of course, we would just take him prisoner, treat him somewhat well, you know, until the conflict's over, right? So
here's another caller at 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Jim, here on the Bible study.
Hey, Brother Chuck.
Good morning.
It seems to me like there's a lot of soldiers coming home, Marines and whatever, with guilty consciences because they've had to kill people on the battlefield.
Yeah.
But I like a pastor. I was in the Marines back during the Korean War, but I never had to see battle.
Okay.
But if I had to go to Korea and fight, the first guy got in my sights, well, he wouldn't go home.
Yeah.
Number one, it's a fight of self defense. You've got two soldiers on the field comparably armed as one another,
right,
and you're out there defending yourself, he's defending himself,
right,
and if you kill him, well, I don't think this is a murder like the Bible would say, but I think it would be a self-defense. And what James said a while ago about in the Second World War, there were Japanese who refused to be rescued, and the Americans just went off and left them, and what else can you do?
Yeah.
You know? But it's the same as Israel going to war. God commanded Israel to go to war with the Hivites, the Philistines, the Jebusites, and the Gergesites, and all these types of people to get them off the face of the earth because of the way they were living and the way they were doing. And maybe other reasons, you know.
Sure.
But I just don't see where, and if Mr. Luther says that it was sin to kill a man on the battlefield, well, your Luther is wrong. At least that's the way I look at it.
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Doctor, your reaction?
Yeah, Luther didn't advocate that. People had that question, Jim. I probably wasn't maybe very clear on that. One of the essays that Luther wrote was, Can a Soldier Be Saved? Because they were troubled in their conscience. And then Luther helped them understand that if the prince has put you into military service and asked you to fight on behalf of the German people in this area here, you're doing God's role inside that place, okay? So That's just Luther there. So no, he didn't. He didn't view it as that. Even though you're taking a life inside battle and things, but that was a question, and I think that is a question that soldiers do have conscience-wise, the things they have to experience and things. But you're right. If someone's at 300 yards pointing a gun at me, you know, seeking to take my life, you're inside a battle there, Jim. And you're right. You have to do what you do in order to. Fight as a soldier, of course, as the government asks you to do, but also just protect your own life so you're not, so you can be around a little bit. Yeah, sure.
Tough questions. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ms. Harris, you're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Oh, hi. When you speak of relationship with God as a Christian,
right, and
I think it's supposed to be a humble relationship. Yeah. And if you were how do you think that we as Christians can, how can we help others who are not Christians to have a different perception of us as Christians if we are arrogant?
Right.
And,
let's ask a mission executive.
Yeah, that's it. You're asking a real important question there. Luther had a real interesting insight. He talks about the quorum relationships. The quorum in Latin means in the presence of another person, okay? And whenever I reflect on the question that, like you just asked, that's what comes to mind for me. That's not how that person looks in my eyes, but how do I look in their eyes? And you're asking a great question, I think, of Christians. Is that how do we look in the eyes of other people? What is our posture? Okay, and that's why, again, to give a reason for the hope that lies within us, yet with gentleness and respect, 1 Peter 3:15 would be one. But then, like Christ, he emptied himself, Philippians 2, and took the form of a servant. I think that becomes maybe a verse. So you're right. You know, how do other people see us? And do they, like it inside Acts, do they perceive that we've been with Jesus? Okay, the way that we're living, the way we live, the way we talk, but also the way that we give. And maybe just one quick story there. I remember John, the apostle. He's dying of old age. He's about 100 years old, maybe, or 90 years old or whatever. And they're carrying him around. He can't walk anymore. And that was what he would always say when he entered the church and was around new people, is that love one another. One of his disciples said, "Well, John, why do you keep on saying that? You know, we're getting, you know." He says, "Well, if we would do it, it would be enough." Okay, was kind of his response, at least according to church history there. So, love, not counting the cost, giving our life for others. These are all important ways, and arrogance is not a good thing. God brings down the arrogant. He humbles them. Again, Mary's song in Luke chapter 1. Yeah.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Jan, you're up next on the Bible study.
Hi, Chuck.
Good
Hi,
morning.
Pastor. First, Pastor, I just want to encourage you know that those of us who don't go into the mission field support you and your colleagues, and it's based on the mandate from Christ that we should go and teach all nations.
Sure.
The second thing is we need to, as Christians, not get ahead of God.
Okay.
I think it's 2 Corinthians 10 where Paul talks about the weapons of our warfare are not carnal.
Okay, sure.
What are we fighting, really?
Yeah.
We are fighting spiritual rebellion.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that St. Augustine of Hippo, first of all, that he was an African.
Right, there you go.
Secondly, he wrote the Rules of Just War, and he was a soldier before he came to Christ.
Huh.
And I just want to share a quote I saw.
Sure, okay.
It is a higher glory to stay war itself with a word than to slay men with the sword and to procure or maintain peace, not by war.
Yeah.
Now, who would understand that better than a soldier?
Yeah.
And we are called to be soldiers of the cross. And when Jesus said, I am sending you as sheep among wolves, therefore be as wise as serpents and as innocent as doves.
Yeah.
So our lives are the witness.
Yeah.
And we need to understand that, you know, like the Greek word for witness is martyr.
There you go, sure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jan.
Yeah, Jan.
Your comments, Doctor?
That's good. No, I agree. It's great if we can have timely words. I think, you know, that's kind of it. But then I guess at the other side, too, Jan, you know, just to think about history, I still remember, I forget which ambassador it was or statesman that went to talk to Hitler, you know, back in 39 or whatever, and said, we have peace in our time. Chamberlain, was it? I can't remember anymore. I should know my history better. And next thing you know, Hitler's invading, you know, the rest of Europe. So, you know, that's always our challenge. Timely words. I think it is a noble thing in order to use words and to use our presence and to seek to persuade and to have peace. But there does come a time, too, I think, where the stick, you know, and force does need to be used. You wish it wouldn't come to that, but in order to stop violent men, I think that becomes part of it. So I think that becomes the other side. Here's an example, just from, again, Luther. It triggered an idea for me, is that Luther said, if we only had sheep in the world, it would be a nice thing, and namely, you know, people that were led by God's Spirit. But he said we don't. And he said the sheep would get along pretty well, but the wolves wouldn't leave them alone very long, I think. So that's kind of Luther's advice, yeah, to princes and to those that have statesman authority. You try to have everyone live as sheep, but the bottom line is, if there's wolves, you still too need to keep people, the sheep alive.
You know, so, Dr. Steinberg, we have just 2 minutes left here, but this conversation has triggered a question in my mind, and that is, I heard on our Morning Essentials program this morning with Paul Clayton that there are veterans, there are an emerging group of veterans now because the United States has been at war for a long time.
Yeah.
And that the VFW and the American Legion, places like that, are beginning, in some places anyway, to swell with new members.
Yeah.
Members in their 20s and 30s. Is this a new mission field in any way?
Well, I think it certainly could be. You know, I think for the soldier, men and women, they have to, it's kind of like the law enforcement officers, maybe too, inside the states. It's a special calling in life, and they get a chance to experience things that are very tragic. I just remember one guy, one time, Chuck, it was about 5 years ago. I saw he's missing a couple of fingers, and I asked how that happened. Of course, it happened in World War II. He was on a boat and got it blown up and stuff like that. And I said, well, let's talk about it. And he says, no, I don't want to talk about it. And so I didn't give up, though, and I gave him another 20 minutes. And eventually he came over and he told me his story. And he says, I haven't told anybody that story in 40 years. Okay. So I think there's a real ministry there. One, of course, to listen. But I think if they're willing to open up just to minister to them, they've seen a stormy side of life, you know, that many of us don't have to ever see or experience. Good buddies getting blown up and... doing these things. So I think you're right, there's a huge mission field, and you're right, it is swelling a little bit, because my dad just died about 6 months ago, and dad was Korean, okay, Korean conflict, okay, and so they had a memorial service there at the local VFW, okay, and so it was kind of interesting going to that, and but you're right, there's generations there now, there's a lot of younger guys, men and women, that are part of that VFW there inside the small town inside
Tony, enjoyed the conversation.
Yep.
Thank you so much for spending an hour with us.
Hey, thank you, Chuck. This is great. Again, thank you so much for your ministry and what you do.
Yep. And blessings to you.
Yeah, you too, Chuck.
That is the Reverend Dr. Anthony Steinbron. He is mission executive with the New Jersey District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Tomorrow we'll continue in the book of Hebrews. We've divided Hebrews 11 into three sections. We'll deal with 17 through 31 in Hebrews 11 tomorrow with Pastor John Shank of Trinity Edwardsville, and our Ask the Pastor guest will be Pastor Gregory Alms from Redeemer Lutheran Church in Catawba, North Carolina. Hope you can listen then.
Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study Archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.